Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
Thank you for joining us and welcome to Mind Food Radio. I hope you've had a fabulous week. Coming up on today's program in a few seconds' time, Dr. Jeannie Mansberg will be joining us on the radio. Joanna Toviar was sent to Bangladesh on a very special story, a very sad story. She'll tell you about that very shortly. Nigella Lawson joins us on the program today. Therese Mudgeway, our kinesiologist, looking at the blame game and some of the interesting insights behind that for you. We're also chatting to James Pitts from Odyssey House and a guy called Sebastian Terry, who has 100 things that he wants to do to complete on his bucket list. And a very insightful story coming up on that one as well. And a little later on, Dr. Ross Walker is also going to join us on the radio. Of course, looking at our heart health here on Mind Food Radio.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Well, I got a bit of a shock today, ladies and gentlemen. Michael walks in wearing bright colours and he goes, hey, I've got my mojo back.
That is so corny. I can't. That should really
That's
be deleted.
That's more me, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
I love mojo. How do we get it?
Well, on the show today, we've got Dr. Jeannie Mansberg, who is the author of How to Get Your Mojo Back. And Jeannie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
The only thing I'm a bit concerned is the next line is, every woman is too busy to stop. What about us blokes?
True, true. You know what? I reckon there's something in this for every bloke.
Right.
It's just that, come and sit in my surgery and there's like a bit of a dearth of blokes around. It's just all girls. So I wrote this for most of my patients, but you know what? You guys, come on board.
Yeah, and you know what? I think book two's got to be what every bloke is, you know, too busy to stop.
Do women lose their mojo?
Yeah, you know what? They've all got it in their 20s.
Yeah.
And somewhere between starting full-time work, having the first kid, and then by the time they've had the second one, they're absolutely on the floor. I sit here in my surgery, and then I just watch their mojo, their spark, their enjoyment of life just sap out of them gradually. And given that, you know, while they come to see me as a GP with a cough, a cold, a sore leg, a sore hip, but what's really going on is they're actually quite worried about how awful and how old they feel. I thought this book was really important to help women just reclaim their vitality, reclaim their youth that they deserve.
Mm.
But isn't it just tiredness?
No, it's so much more than that. You know, I agree with you. I think tiredness is a huge part of it, but it's stress. It's not handling your stress properly and the impact that that has on all of your relationships and your performance at work.
Mm.
But also, like, your spark in the bedroom, your ability to, you know, stop putting on weight, it's all of that stuff rolled into one, and your immune system going troppo as well.
It's kind of interesting, though, because, you know, that phase of life that you have described, everyone goes through that, don't they? And yet probably as society, we're not that kind to each other around that phase, do you think?
I think that's right. You know, we put so much effort into the people around us, trying so hard to make sure that they're okay.
Mm.
And guys, I'm sorry to tell you, but I really do think it's women who don't put themselves first. You know, they are amazing friends, amazing partners, incredibly sacrificing and giving daughters and mothers. But when it comes to putting the energy into themselves, they feel too guilty somehow to do it.
Mm.
But what they don't get is, you know how when you get on the aeroplane and they say, you know, if the oxygen mask falls, fit yourself first and then look after those around you. Because the aeroplanes have worked out that if mum falls over, like the kids are goners anyway, women don't really get that.
Yeah, the husbands would be putting it on first, probably.
Yeah, well, I mean, the guys get it.
Yeah.
It's not that they're selfish. It's just that they've worked it out pretty clearly that if they come home from work absolutely exhausted and the kids are screaming and they don't just take the time to go to the toilet and have a drink if they need it, that they're actually not going to be much good for anyone. But somehow women don't. And I think part of it as well is we are a little bit of the martyr. You know, like we sometimes really love stressing out and being really worn out. We wear it as a badge of honour, whereas blokes are like, nah. And you beat yourself up about it.
Yeah.
And instead of stopping to smell the coffee, it just all becomes this great big huge thing of stress. And look, don't forget, there are, I mean, the financial situation in Australia is difficult at the moment.
Yeah.
People are, you know, that people are very worried about their jobs. And work has become, I think, far more stressful. Even in the last 12 months, I've noticed in my surgery how much more freaked out by work people are.
I think it's sad, though, in today's world that mums don't get to be mums anymore. I mean, you know,
I'm going to be honest with you, and I love my kids. I love them to death. But if I had to be a stay-at-home mum, I'd be really, really unhappy. I'd be far more stressed doing that because I wouldn't find it as satisfying.
Yeah.
I love going to work, but we need to find a way that you can go to work and feel fulfilled in your career, not living through your children.
Yeah.
But that also doesn't make you feel like you've just been run over by a truck 24/7.
Very interesting. Well, Dr. Jeannie Mensberg, thank you very much for joining us today on the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Nice to have you. Yes, and the author of a brand new book too called How to Get Your Mojo Back. And of course, for more details, go on to mindfood.com.
Mindfood Radio, smart thinking, the perfect gift idea, is a Mindfood magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
It's Mind Food Radio with Ben Starr, and Joanna Tovia is joining us on the line. She's been to Bangladesh and she's been following a very interesting story. I suppose, would you call it a social issue story, Joanne?
Yes, it's quite a powerful social issue story and something that I think the global community definitely needs to know about.
Mm-hmm. And as a journalist, I suppose you go on these trips with an open mind thinking, well, I'm not going to have any thoughts till I get there, or do you research before you leave?
Well, I went with a photographer, and we travelled about 4 hours from the main city, and Save the Children took us inside this brothel, which is actually the biggest brothel in Asia. The women live and work there. Their rooms are about 2 metres by 2 metres, and they live there with their children. So that was quite confronting. They're just corrugated iron and brick shacks, and the streets are filled with garbage, and it's horrific, actually.
It would be just terrible.
It was. It was hard to see and to know that these women have no choice. A lot of them are sold into the brothel when they're children,
right,
or when they're about 12 years old. And then they owe the landlady that they've been sold to the money. They have to pay back the money that the landlady's paid for them. So they're stuck there and entertaining, you know, up to 10 clients a night at 12 years old. So that's fairly confronting, and of course, a lot of them fall pregnant, so there's a lot of children around. A lot of them are just left in the streets to fend for themselves while their mothers entertain clients. So that was probably the most confronting thing, especially seeing the young toddlers wandering around with no clothes on without their mums.
It is confronting. So then how do you put it into a story to change the world?
Well, the work that Save the Children's doing in the brothel, they've been working there since 1996, is actually really positive and really hopeful. So, I mean, I guess my job is to outline the issues because they are terrible, but 20 years ago it was a lot more terrible. So Save the Children has put wealth into the community. The people there, the sex workers, are no longer thrown in the river when they die. They're buried. They're allowed to wear shoes. Save the Children has built a preschool and a school. So for part of the day at least, those children, you know, from as young as 3, are taken away from the brothel and given lessons and kindness from teachers.
I suppose it's a vicious circle too, because, you know, if that's what mum became, it's highly likely if you're a daughter or a son of hers that that's what you'll become as well.
That's the problem. And the clients there demand, well, the biggest demand is for the youngest girls. So once a woman hits about 30, she's no longer wanted. She's old. She's past it. And so because there's no other option for her to make money, she has no choice but to involve her children in the same business, because without income, they starve.
And there's no way that these people can ever get out of that cycle of that land person or the woman owning them.
Well, no, that bondage period only lasts for about 3 years.
Right.
But to get out, a lot of them a lot of the previous generation are illiterate. They have no other skills. And there's nowhere for them to go. If they arrived at 12 years old or are born into it, that's all they know.
So education is what you're saying is really the key to snapping this, the changing the whole wheel.
It's a start. A start. Yeah.
So what can people do to help in this type of situation?
Well, Save the Children Australia and Save the Children New Zealand are funding different projects here. So go online and donate, and you can specifically request that your money goes to this program. And it really is making a massive difference to see these children laughing and playing and learning. At the preschool, I sat down in some of the classrooms and played with the kids. It was just so wonderful. So.
Well, Joanna, very sad story that you had to go and report on, with probably a lovely outcome in the fact that at least you're talking about it and getting the word out there to people. And as you say, if people want to get behind it, they can jump online to Save the Children and donate through that way.
That's a pleasure, Ben.
This is a big interview for us.
It is.
And I love chocolate. I love watching TV. I love watching this woman on TV.
Nigella Lawson. Look, she's so popular all around the world. She's been to Australia many, many times. Last year, she was on MasterChef.
Mm.
And yeah, it's great to have her here as our very first interview on Mind Food Radio. So, Nigella, what's the weather like?
I'm in London. I'm in very, very cold early morning London.
Well, I have to say, Nigella, when it comes to cooking, did you always like cooking?
Well, I'll tell you how, it was just slightly slower than that. I was just expected to cook as a child, and I was interested in food, although, funnily enough, not a great eater. But I liked, you know, it interested me in how it was cooked, and I thought about it. And then when I went to university, I found that just being used to cooking, being around cooking, made me the kind of, you know, the house cook. Also because, you know, I cook without a recipe, and I cooked cheap food, as you have to. I mean, that taught me the most, because cooking on a budget is really the best way of learning how to cook, because you have to learn how to make things taste good when the, you know, when the ingredients aren't so fabulous. So that's really when I became aware that actually I liked cooking and it was what I did. It wasn't because I really wanted to, it's just how it came. I suddenly realized I was the one who cooked. And then I found, you know, when I left and started working, I don't know, it just was an interest. Plus, really, it's a very good way as a journalist of putting off writing. And when I was a columnist, you know, when I was an op-ed columnist, I found that I would often make soup, because that's chopping and stirring. Very good way of not getting that awful brain freeze that you can get as you just sit staring at a computer.
Nigella, is eating in bed your ultimate indulgence?
Well, I don't think it's such a terrible thing. Therefore, it doesn't. It's not the ultimate indulgence in the sense of like, oh, it's this forbidden, wicked thing. It is nice. You're always not meant to do it. I don't like eating knife and fork food lying in bed, because then it becomes uncomfortable. But, you know, spooning food, excellent. And no cutlery food, very good. I mean, well, a bacon sandwich, fantastic. At the moment, I'm going through a kind of phase of rhubarb yogurt with pomegranate seeds in it. And I spoon that as I watch TV very happily. My bedside table has got mustard, Tabasco, salt, pepper, some crushed chilies. I mean, it looks like part of the kitchen.
Now, tell us about your brand new DVD.
I so love it that the DVDs get in Australia, because in a sense, I feel that, well, I'm such a DVD person myself. I think there's nothing nicer, really, than lying in bed with a box set. I feel the recipes are so varied in it, so that it kind of takes in the whole of life. You know, quick food, food you cook when you're stressed, food that you cook when you've got a bit of time, not necessarily in the kitchen, but that you can go and do other things. And I'm a great believer in, you either want to cook fast or you want things that don't need a lot done to them, and then do it all in the oven. So I'm pleased about this. I'm really pleased.
Now, the flirtatious personality we see on TV, how close is that to the real Nigella?
I feel that once you get this whole thing about being in some way flirtatious or something, it's leapt on. My real feeling about that is that when I go around, and whether I'm in England or Australia, or if I do a book signing, people who come to it, they don't have that view of me. They've seen me from the TV. I think it becomes a shorthand. The one thing I'm not is a vamp. If you start thinking that what people say about you defines you, you're in trouble.
So, Nigella, when you're on set, how do you handle all that beautiful food?
When I film, it's not that I eat the food there, it's that the hours are so long and you get so tired. If I'm getting very stressed and overworked and not sleeping enough, it's like someone's taken a bicycle pump to me.
So sorry for the interruption, but we have gone over time and we really do need to wrap
okay.
this up.
Well, Nigella and Michael, it looks like we're getting the wind-up, the satellite feed again.
Thanks, Nigella.
Bye.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Well, Therese Mudgway always has some interesting information for us, and today we thought we'd get into the topic of the blame game. Therese, what is this all about?
Well, it's a common thing that we find in our society today, and let's face it, it's always much easier to blame someone else, including our life not working out,
mm-hmm.
than it is to take responsibility for it yourself.
So what happens, like, in relationships and stuff? You know, when people separate, should they mm-hmm. both be taking responsibility, or is it more one person than the other?
The scary thing is that the moment you step into the space of the blame game,
mm-hmm.
you also step in the space of being a victim or victimhood.
Now, there's a lot of victims out there, though, isn't there?
Yeah, we're all guilty of stepping into that space. But the thing is, then you don't actually have to step into victimhood.
Yeah.
And today I'll give you the antidote for it. Now, you may not necessarily like it, but there are so many aspects of our lives that we look at and we blame the economy, we blame the government, we blame our parents, we blame the kids, we blame the financial status, the market,
mm-hmm.
we blame our boss, we blame our... But the moment you're pointing a finger out, you consider you fall into the world of victimhood. And it could be something as simple as blaming the traffic because you're late.
And a lot of people do that.
Yeah, it's a common thing, especially in Sydney, right?
Yeah, but a lot of people blame everybody for their lot in life as well, too, don't they?
Completely.
Mm.
And the interesting thing to always look at is underneath blame and victimhood is one thing, and that is fear.
Well, yeah, a life lived in fear is a life half lived, and fear, I suppose, is fear part of everybody?
Yeah, we need fear.
Mm-hmm.
And we need fear to protect us.
Yeah.
However, a lot of the fear is not real.
Mm.
So if we take the really, really simple example, because I think this is a common one that everybody deals with and uses,
mm.
about getting to a meeting, say, or meeting your husband or your wife or whatever for dinner, and you say, oh, I'm sorry I was late.
Mm.
It was my boss held me up or the traffic or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the moment you're blaming something other than yourself,
mm.
you're in a state of victimhood. You're a victim of the traffic. You're a victim of your boss.
Right.
But what's driving it is fear, because it may be the fear of you don't want to get into trouble or disappoint or let down the person who you're meeting.
Kids are very good, though, at spinning a story, aren't they, so that they don't get that response.
Yeah, right. And what drives that? Fear. So
yeah.
it gets ingrained at a very young age, because we don't want to get into trouble. We don't want to upset someone. We don't want to let people down.
Mm.
And that is all based on fear.
Well, what do you think we should do then to put in place to change these patterns so that we, well, actually, eventually, we'll be having a lot better life instead of blaming everybody?
Yeah, absolutely. Because the moment you take responsibility, you're back in a place of power. So, for example, if we take again the whole being late because of whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
rather than being a reaction to your circumstance or reacting to the environment,
mm-hmm.
you can act in accordance with the facts. Two very different things.
Mm.
So if I'm running late, I can say, I am sorry that I am late. I did not allow enough time.
Ah, so now you're taking responsibility.
I'm taking responsibility. Not like I'm bad or wrong, not like it's my fault, but I'm taking responsibility.
Well, I tell you what, some great advice again. And I think, you know, it's one of those things that it doesn't happen overnight. You've got to work at this, don't you? You've got to sort of mentally put it into your brain. But also, I'm a visual person, so sometimes I have to write things down like this and then maybe cut out photos out of a magazine that represent those things to me so that I put it on a wall. And every time I walk past it, I keep reminding myself of what I've got to be doing.
Absolutely, Ben, and that's a really, really brilliant idea.
Well, thank you very much, Therese. Always very interesting information. And, of course, for
pleasure.
More details, you can jump onto mindfood.com. She's always got some great advice. And, of course, you can find out her contact details at mindfood.com.
Thanks, Ben.
We're about to talk to James Pitts. He's the CEO of Odyssey House, and for the fifth consecutive year, alcohol has outstripped illicit drugs like heroin and cannabis in terms of the leading reason for entering treatment at Odyssey House. Hi, James.
Hello, how are you?
Now, that's quite an extraordinary statistic.
It is, but you know, it's about the third year in a row, and when it first happened about 3 years ago, certainly it took us by surprise, because our organization has always been associated with illicit drug use. And so while people certainly drank, the majority of people would nominate illicit drugs like heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine as their primary drug of concern. So this happened about 3 years ago, was the first notification, and it's been a pretty steady category.
And what do you think's happening out there in society that, you know, they're turning to the drink? I guess it's been happening for many, many years, as the statistics are showing.
You know, I think that I'm actually in the process, and I'll be, you know, maybe in about 9 months I'll be able to give you a more definitive answer. But I had the theory that I have, and that we're following up, we're doing a project just to nail this down, is that we have a lot of people who now come into the program And while it has traditionally been, you know, for people who have illicit drug problems, that a lot of people now who have had a long history of alcohol dependence are finally showing up to take advantage of treatment. And one of the phenomena is that when you ask people, well, how did you end up here? You know, what's the epidemiology, that they'll say, well, look, you know, I always heard of Odyssey House, but I didn't know that, you know, it was for people who had alcohol problems. So I think that as we've had more people who have been taking advantage of participation in the program, by word of mouth, we've gotten a lot more people. But on a bigger picture, the fact is that, you know, that there's just more people drinking at risky levels. While the actual level of alcohol dependence has kind of held the line, you know, and has gone back and forth, you know, like increase, slight decrease, that kind of thing. But I think that what you see is just the people are drinking at more risky levels. In other words, drinking a lot more in a relatively shorter period of time.
So when someone comes to Odyssey House and they enter that, what are the next steps for them?
The next steps, particularly for people who are alcohol dependent, there's a difference between the two drugs that you really are concerned about medically, alcohol and benzodiazepine use. Because the withdrawal from those drugs, somebody is dependent upon those two classes of drugs, when they're withdrawing, that they really need some kind of medical assistance. Otherwise, they run the risk that certainly that they can have seizures, grand mal seizures, and certainly can cause a lot of other complications. So normally when somebody comes to us who is alcohol dependent, before they actually go into the rehabilitation stage of the program, that they go through our withdrawal unit. So that they are actually over a 7 to 10 day period that they are observed by the medical staff, that they are given medication which assists them in coming down, you know, to a level of zero withdrawal before they actually participate in the program.
Just quickly, yes. If people want to get in contact with you, what's the best way to do that?
The best way to get in touch with us is they can call our admissions and intake center. The number is 02-9281-5144.
Fantastic. Now, of course, more information on mindfood.com. James Pitts, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Okay. CEO of Odyssey House, Alcohol and Depression. Really interesting topic, Michael, and one that we've got to keep working on.
There's a lot more detail on mindfood.com for anyone who's listening, you know, whether they're interstate, they can tap in there, and there's lots of information there that can and help them with some solutions.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
Well, everybody has at least one thing they have to do before they die, so having a list is a good thing. But how many goals and dreams on that list are actually achieved? Well, in 2009, at the ripe old age of 27, Sebastian realised that, like most people, he'd not achieved anything, particularly in his lifelong dreams. So I've got him on the line today to tell us his story and how he got to, well, making 100 things happen. You've done some cool stuff here, running with the bulls, marrying a stranger, triathlon, you've done chasing a tornado. I mean, you've done some crazy stuff out there.
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't think my list is a template for what other people should base it on. It's all very relative. And so,
yeah.
You know, I ask everyone what's on your list, and a lot of people just say, oh, I want to read more, I'd like to connect with a loved one. So it's not necessarily financial, but regardless, I think it's really important that people take the time to just make a list,
yep,
and identify these goals, and I think you find a lot of purpose. Certainly I have. I found a lot of purpose in just chasing these dreams.
So what have you learned about yourself from doing all this?
I've learned that over time, the whole list started from, you know, a place where I'd lost a friend, and I realised that I wasn't particularly happy with my own life, and I, you know, at that moment I thought, well, you know what, I'm going to make a list of things that I want to do that might make me happy, and that was the, you know, that was the beginning of it all. I've learned that I needed to do that. I think as people we need a really solid foundation to base, you know, whatever it is we want to do on.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm learning that I love this idea of trying to help others. And luckily through my journey, I'm able to go around and help people tick things from their list. So yeah, I'm learning that sort of stuff about myself. I think the best thing as people we can do is to help someone else.
So being stuck on a desert island, what happened there? What did you think about as you sat on a desert island?
Am I the only person to want to do this? Have you ever
I reckon everybody would like to do it. Actually, there's a show on the BBC in the UK, and they do a radio show called Desert Island Requests, and they ask celebrities to come in and talk about what songs would you like to play if you're on a desert island. But what was it like? It must have been quiet.
It was. I've never been alone in my life. I've always been around friends or a sporting team or whatever. So, yeah, I wanted to be alone. I was 55 kilometres off the mainland of New Caledonia.
Yep.
Stuck on a desert island that took 10 minutes to walk around. There were sea snakes, poisonous sea snakes, I should say, everywhere. Turtles, little sharks every single evening circling the island. It sounds like I'm lying, doesn't it? I ate coconuts for a week. I took with me a machete. It was unbelievable. Just silence, pure silence, and it was beautiful. I highly recommend that, actually. I'd love to. If anyone wants to do that, get in touch with me. I'll tell you where to go.
That's a silence retreat. Now, what about the tornadoes? Because over in America, there are guys that really do this as a profession, and you were lucky enough to go along on one of these expeditions.
Yeah, it was awesome. I spent 10 days kind of going through Texas and all those southern states, just chasing these extreme weather patterns. So, I mean, I've never... Don't get me wrong, there was some incredibly exciting times. Saw a tornado come and touch down on the land not too far from us. It was just unbelievable. But there were also days where it was just quite beautiful and it was just a lovely sunny day.
Yeah, that's right. And look, I reckon that the best way to do that is to kick it off with writing down a couple of goals, like even if it's five or six goals that you want to achieve. And it could, and not necessarily things that you want to do. It could be things you need to work on yourself, you know, to change so that you can have the life that you want. Because sometimes it's us that holds ourselves back, I think.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's simply that the first step in achieving any goal, I think, is just identifying it. It's goal setting and just setting that goal. I think it's then just committing to it and balancing it in your current lifestyle.
Exactly.
I think it's as simple as that.
So if we want to get behind you, we go to the website, and the best way to do that is just go to 100things.com.au and then follow the links from there, hey?
Absolutely, all very, very easy. And again, if it's one thing, 10 things or a million things, just start writing. I think it's an amazing process. So if anyone comes, I'd love to talk to you online.
Fantastic. Sebastian, thanks for your time today.
Oh, you're a legend. Thanks so much for having me.
And Mind Food Radio, we are moving more into the health side of things now, Michael.
We are. I welcome to the show Dr. Ross Walker. He's got a brand new book, The Five Stages of Health. Welcome to the show, Ross.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Ben.
So tell us about your new book.
Well, the new book is called The Five Stages of Health, and the reason I've called it that is because I think that what we do in medicine is we give people treatment with drugs or surgery or certainly a lot of sophisticated procedures, and then the person walks out with a script pad and after having a stent in their arteries, say, for example, if they had a heart problem, but that I don't think that's enough. I think it's very effective to treat the acute problem, but it doesn't really often deal with the underlying issues or other things that may be going on in their life.
Yeah.
Now, the second stage of health is what I call environmental health. So we're not really thinking too much about the effects of, say, for example, dirty electricity. We're all sitting in front of computers and we have mobile phones and we're sitting under fluorescent lights, and there's a fair bit of mounting evidence that a lot of this stuff is not particularly good for the body. And also the subtle chemical poisons. So, for example, the BPA or bisphenol A that's in plastics. And if you open the fridge, you look in the fridge, almost everything's in some sort of plastic container. And again, what is this doing to our health? So I'm looking at that in the book as well. The third stage is what I call genetic health. So your father had a heart attack in his 40s. You might be in your 30s. I think it's about time you start having checkups to see, do you have similar genetic factors in your bloodstream? Mm-hmm. And we can do stuff about that as well.
Yeah.
And then the fourth stage is emotional health. So you can't stand your partner, you don't like your kids, you don't enjoy your job, you decide to have a heart attack in the middle of it. Mm. You go back to the kids, the partner and the job you don't enjoy, nothing's going to change. So you either have to change your situation, or better still, change your attitude to your situation. And then the final stage is what I call mind health. Now, this is the bit that's going to cause a little bit of conjecture, shall we say, with my more conservative colleagues, where I believe we have these energies in the body that correspond to the seven universal laws of life. And if you get a block in one of those areas, that can bring out an issue. So that's what that section's all about.
But Ross, you, in your job, you must see people walk through the door and you think, time bomb.
Yep.
And then you say to them, you've got to lose weight, you've got to stop smoking, and you've got to stop drinking, and you've really got to start to take control of your life. It must be very frustrating when they don't do it.
Oh, no, but the Walker rule number two of medicine is very straightforward. The patient's the one with the disease. It's not my problem. I'm just here to give advice and to try and help people. If they don't want to help themselves, well, that's their issue.
Mm. How frustrating, though, is it, Ross, when perhaps, you know, if you'd seen that patient 10 or 15 years ago and you really could have implemented a strategy for them and they listened and they did it, they wouldn't be in the situation they are now.
It's very frustrating. And I, when I hear of, say, somebody in their 50s dropping dead, if I'd have seen them 10 years before, I could have prevented that illness. And that's, I find that extremely frustrating, which is why I stress the importance of having proper screening rather than just waiting till the problem's happening. See, this is the problem in modern medicine. We have the ambulance parked at the bottom of the cliff, waiting for people to fall off. So rather than fixing the rails at the top, what we do in medicine is build faster ambulances. And it's really a very silly way of approaching medical issues.
As a doctor, how important then is cholesterol?
Oh, look, I think cholesterol is an important risk factor, but I still think it's overdone by the medical profession. I think really, once you hit 50, blood pressure is much more important than cholesterol as a risk for heart disease. Mm-hmm. And I really get disturbed by this excessive use of statin drugs for people who don't actually need them. So look, cholesterol is important. I'm not demeaning it as a risk factor, but I don't treat cholesterol, I treat risk. So if I find people to be at very high risk for heart disease, which means they've already had a heart attack or a stent or a bypass, or they've got a bucket of muck in their arteries on my non-invasive testing, then I'll treat their cholesterol. But if someone's cholesterol's high and they have not very much in their arteries at all, and we can detect that these days, I couldn't give a tinker's about their cholesterol.
Because you've got that great machine. Is it still like a photo imaging thing?
That's it. It's a calcium score of the coronary arteries, which measures how much muck you've got. And I believe all men at 50, all women at 60 should have a calcium score of their coronary arteries, which measures how much muck you've got.
Dr. Ross, thank you for coming on the show, and your new book, Five Stages of Health, is on sale now. So thank you very much.
Gentlemen, it's been wonderful talking with you.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
And welcome back to Mind Food. Well, I thought this would be an interesting segment for us today because everybody's talking about insects and mozzies and rodents and stuff like that. So I've got a guy who's passionate about all this stuff. Andrew from Pestrol Australia is joining us on the line. How are you, Andrew?
Good, Ben. What would you like to know about something?
Well, look, I think it's interesting. This time of year, what's going on? I mean, we've got rodent problems. We're seeing lots of cockroaches. We've got insect problems everywhere. What are some ways that we can sort of eradicate them without, you know, going overboard, I suppose?
Okay. Well, look, a couple of things you can do around your home if you do live within a home environment. We've had a lot of rain this season, of course, around the country. And just get rid of some of the outdoor puddles that may have popped up because that can be a great breeding ground, of course, for mosquitoes. But for around the home, we sell a product, Ben, called the Pestrol Ultra. Mm-hmm. It's a dispenser, an automatic time dispenser. We've been selling these now in Australia for close to 10 years, if not longer.
Yep.
What they do, Ben, actually, is you've probably heard of pyrethrums. It comes out of Tasmania. It's a chrysanthemum flower. And what happens, part of the formulation is the pyrethrums. It disperses at a timed amount. Insects detected around your home. Nothing worse than having mosquitoes waking you up in the middle of the night. I used to just put a sheet over my head and hope that I'd go away. But with the dispenser that we sell, and we sell them Australia-wide, you put it on, they detect it, they move away. If they don't, they die. And if you're home, you can even leave the doors and windows open, which is great.
Now tell me, look, I'm one of these guys that believes in keeping everything nice and clean, but that doesn't really mean anything to these types of little things like cockroaches and things, does it?
No, that's a funny thing because people go, oh, I might have cockroaches in my home. Does that mean that I have a messy home? Well, it certainly doesn't. You might have really old cavities or there could be things happening outside your understanding.
Yeah.
You can even bring a box back from the supermarket or from a store and you can have eggs that are dormant in a box and cockroach eggs can lay dormant for 2 or 3 months before they finally come out. So it's just a case of being vigilant, but it doesn't mean that you're not clean at all. In fact, it's just what happens when you live in this beautiful country of ours where you have to deal with insects.
So what are some ways we can get rid of the cockroaches? Do we use the Ultra as well or is there something else?
Well, we do sell a range of products, of course, but the Ultra will also assist with the cockroaches.
Yeah.
But during the winter months, we really sell quite heavily on radio and on TV a product we call the Pestrol Rodent Free. So it works with the rodents and also helps with the control of cockroaches in your home as well.
Now, for our listeners listening around the country today in regional markets and places like that, rodents are just a common thing that you might see around the home, but the damage they can do is unreal, isn't it?
Look, it is. I mean, from, you know, I think we're talking of the teeth of a rat never stop growing. So they've always got to be gnawing on something just to wear the teeth down. We sell this product right throughout Australia. And, of course, other than electrical wiring, which can be particularly dangerous, they can eat through parts of your home. And, you know, we quite often get cases where people have to, you know, if you put down baits, and don't get me wrong, there's a lot of great things on the market, but if you don't have animals and you're not worried about it being around children, they can eat baits, they can go back into a wall cavity, and they can die there. And then all of a sudden, you've got an issue with trying to get rodents, decaying rodents, out of wall cavities. So
yeah, that leaves a lasting impression and a smell, doesn't it?
It sure does. The beauty of this Pestrol Rodent Free, of course I'm pushing my own product, but we have sold tens upon thousands of these units. You plug it in. I know it sounds almost mysterious and almost too good to be true, but the amount of feedback we've had has been fantastic. It sends a pulse through the electrical wiring in your home, which is great because it gets into those places that you can't necessarily put baits down.
Yeah.
It sends out a frequency that they don't like, they get irritated by it, and they move on. And often with this product, you can notice a difference within 2 to 3 days, and nothing worse than hearing things running around in your ceiling and you're trying to go to sleep.
Now, I'm looking up into the ceiling thinking, what is that moving in the roof?
Nothing at all, Ben. But look, always a pleasure to chat, and I hope we can chat again soon sometime.
Well, that's the program, folks. Thank you for your company. Join us again next week right here on Mind Food Radio. Of course, you can check out the iPad version of the magazine by jumping into the iTunes store. And join us next week. We'll do it all again. Until then, have a safe week, won't you? And of course, if you missed anything today, just jump onto mindfood.com and click on the radio column.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking, was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick K. Roos. Bogart Torelli speaking.